We're going to keep our series of talks and conversations under the title of Radical Corruption. Most welcome to you, Natasha Felix, from What, How and For Whom. Thank you so much for coming. We are very excited that you are here. We are looking forward to this talk. Before I give the word to you, I just want to give a short introduction to your work in What, How and For Whom. What, How and For Whom is a curator collective that has existed since 1999. Your four curators and one graphic designer working together. Besides directing the exhibition space Gallery Nova in Zagreb, where you're based, you have also directed a wide range of production, exhibition and projects. Since the beginning of What, How and For Whom's collaboration, you have been developing models based on collective ways of working, creative use of public space, and collaborations between partners of different backgrounds. Primarily shaped by the format of the exhibition, your projects have been conceived as platforms for progressive modes of cultural production and reception of social realities. What, how, and for whom are the three basic questions of every economic organization concerned the planning, concept, and realization of exhibitions, as well as the production of distribution of artworks and the artist's position in the labor market. These questions form the title of your first project dedicated to the 152nd anniversary of the Commune. The manifesto in 2000 in Zagreb and became the motto of the work and of course the title of the collective. And one of the recent events is the Istanbul Biennial in 2009, What Keeps Mankind Alive, where you brought 70 artists from a wide range of countries with the majority of from Eastern Europe and the Middle East. And another project of yours I will mention is the exhibition Ground Floor America from 2010, because it was shown here in Copenhagen at Den Fri. In this exhibition you trace parallels between the depression in the 1930s till today's economic crisis. And last and most recently, I just want to mention that you curated the creation pavilion for the 54th Venice Biennale. And today you have chosen to talk under the title Defining the Enemy and Post-Fordist Business as Usual. So,
thank you very much for this extensive introduction. Thank you all for coming. So, I will be leaving my lecture. I hope I will not be too fast, but I hope you can follow my Catholic English. So the title is Defining the Enemy and What Project Business as Usual. At the beginning of Terry Gilliam's film Brazil from 1985, a dystopian SS black comedy which depicts a future society more or less organized around terrorism, or more precisely against terrorism, in many of its details, astonishing and precisely depicting. I have to speak louder. So at the beginning of this film, which in many of its details, astonishingly precisely depicts things that really did happen 20-something years later. So at the beginning, in a TV interview, they asked the Minister of Finance, how come the terrorists are active already for 13 years? And the minister answers, the Guinness luck. This could also be how things stand in Becavet, or WHW, which we pronounce always as Becavet, which is English abbreviation of the name of the curatorial collective, What, How and For Whom, of whom I'm a member together with Anna Devich, Hilda Schulin, Sabina Zobolovic, the four of us are curators and designer and publicist Jan Krčić. And we work together since 1999. In my talk today, I will discuss the practice of Becavet against the background of specific moments of urgency that have been played out in so-called post-transitional, normalized social and cultural context at the outside border of the European Union where we were, in Zagreb, Croatia, completed on the 19th of December this year should sign the agreement on joining the European Union. In the 20th year of its independence after its defeat from Yugoslavia in 1990, and 15 years after the end of the war, which followed its secession, and that saved from Macedonia, included all the present independent states on the territory of former Socialist Federative Republic of Yugoslavia. The negotiations with the European Union are closed and Croatia should become a member of the EU by the end of 2013, of course providing that by then the European Union did not dissolve or through war so radical into this actual form of its demise in the present form, which is not completely unimaginable, or the Croatian people in the referendum on joining the European Union do not vote against it, which is also not completely unimaginable, as in the last years the zest for joining the EU very much declined, with nationalist right-wing arguments joined by skepticism from the liberal camp. Although Europe is still seen as a measure of civilization, with the role of art and culture being to testify and prove that we are cultural, not only that we belong to Europe, but that we have always belonged there. This fascination with Europe in the 90s was accompanied with hysteric and rather unsuccessful efforts to get rid of the destination Balkans, the geographical label that during the 90s transformed into one of the strongest derogatory terms in history, in international relations, in political sciences, and even in general intellectual discourse. And the term itself became a symptom of Europe that embodies all that is wrong in the utopian notion of the aesthetic multicultural consensus, multicultural in the 90s, of the European Union. And on the other hand, Balkan was also performing as European other, whose role is in fact to secure Western identity as a single and coherent unity, covering up for the fact that the West is also a heterogeneous, inclusive system with its own centers and peripheries, imbued with antagonisms, and that these very antagonisms are constitutive for every contemporary society. So today I will try to delineate practice of Bekave during the last decade, beginner's luck, as I said, against some specific intensities and stakes, of which I already mentioned some, that characterize coup d'etats, dislocations and condensations of the contradictory movements during that same period that completed transition from Fordism to post-Fordism, allocated to art the central place in the new economy, as well as attempts to navigate pressures brought about by this transition away from betrayal, cooptation and assimilation. These attempts to navigate the way have certainly become the central question, with flexibility and inclusiveness of foundation sector as dominant material basis for contemporary art production, taking over critical discourse within its rhetoric, with a new post-Fordist regime in which parts of cognitive criteria, such as participation, knowledge sharing, networking, managing and cooperation, criteria which intend to realize human potential and abolish the formal division of labor, they in fact became exploitative moments of production. And also as a moment when the role of state is no longer to institutionalize class compromise, but to attract capital investment under its jurisdiction and to guarantee safe reproduction of capital. But I should start from the beginning, which is not to say that it's easy to pinpoint this beginning. In a straightforward talk about Bekave's practice, the beginning goes definitely back to the late 90s and our first project, as you mentioned already, which was called What, How and For Whom, on the occasion of 152nd anniversary of the Communist Manifesto. Here is the color of the capital that we published in that occasion. So what, how and for whom, as you said, three basic questions of every economic organization, which we took at the time as the title of the exhibition, because the exhibition was not being straightforward in the communism, it was more a result of frustration with complete collective amnesia of socialist past. It's absolutely no debate about the possible future development of the country as it relates to neoliberal capitalism is the only way open to humanity. So the exhibition dealt actually with economy and with the questions, what are and to whom are the three basic questions of every economic organization. We put them in the title, and in 2001 we registered as a non-government organization and we still work as an NGO. Since 2003 we run together in MOVA, which is a city-owned space for which we are directing the program. As a collective, which is also kind of negotiations, of course, with this year the honor of the gallery to accept collective leadership space. So to go back to comments on the first exhibition, it was realized in 2000, at the moment in the grip of the 90s politics, characterized by mobilization of extreme right-wing ideologies that engaged intellectual establishments with struggles for uniqueness of national culture against what was considered a black cultural hegemony, interpreted as a foreign external element that threatened the purity of national culture and national identity. But in the late 90s, this grip slowly loosened up. In the 90s, nationalism was the cohesive element that provided the ground for intellectually immature political classes with old-fashioned ideologies and schematic programs to suffocate social movements that during the 80s threatened the balance of public discourse. They managed to destroy the public and devastate social space by introducing autarkic nationalist discourse and counter-capitalism. In a cultural landscape characterized by the bureaucratic sluggishness and conceptual disorientation of institutions that sprang up in the 90s, in the confusion of the so-called transition with its rediscovery of capitalism, crumbling social infrastructures, quest for the holy grail of national identity, and complete suppression of socialist history, intellectually we felt closer to the so-called civil scene that in the 90s developed specific political meanings than to a system of white institutions. Our work is in that respect part of the broader non-institutional scene that through a number of networks and collaborating independent cultural activities in the years following the change of government in 2000 proliferated and intensify its active opposition towards institutional cultural production based on the logic of identity, national identity, first of all. Of course, if we talk about the beginnings of what we today call post-Fordism, as it pertains to our practice, then cultural work is, along with all the other occupations, forced to prove its usefulness for society at large, to legitimize its activities as being socially reproductive in terms of making money, or in terms of keeping up the ideologically bureaucratic apparatuses of the society, and that even so unproductive activities as acting, speaking, thinking are forced to undergo commodification or reproductive socialization, we could situate it earlier, at the very beginning of the processes that in the 90s went under the name of transition. Maybe I should say transitology, which is a term by Taiwanese maybe Sherwani, which is desirable, to define this as the quasi-scientific discourse on transition from socialistic authoritarianism to liberal democracy, embedded in the doxa about the Western neoliberal capitalism being the only solution for post-socialist reality. And this is really the doxa that was absolutely governing political and social life in the 90s. But when we go about the beginnings of post-Fordism, maybe we go also a bit earlier. This process could be seen as a culmination of a long and gradual process of abandonment of socialist self-management, which is what Gal Kiern, the sociologist from Ljubljana, argues in his article that he published in a book he edited last year under the title Post-Fordism and its Discontent. Because he claims that socialist self-management in itself contained the seeds of many elements of what today we call post-Fordism. At first it sounds paradoxical that post-Fordism started and showed some of its first manifestations in the margin of Europe. But he explains further. He explains that in socialist self-management, he recognizes post-Fordist tendency in major innovations within economy, starting with first market reforms of self-management in 1965, with which introduced new forms of self-exploitation and cooperation. He also recognized in the feminist figure of the flexible self-managed worker that stressed the socialist emancipation within the theory of alienation, which was the leading theory. And this socialism in humanist phase, which is something which was specific for Yugoslavia, is something that is very strong. And he also recognizes elements of postmodernism in an important stress on knowledge, especially realized through a series of educational reforms that started in the 70s, and these reforms got him regarded as Bologna Declaration of Ancla Letter, managerial bureaucratic synthesis that engaged to improve efficiency of economy and labor markets. I'm one of the last generations educated in this system of socialist educational reforms. These elements are also crucial for understanding subsequent wars in Yugoslavia that were not the consequence of some ancient religious and national hatred, as they were often seen in the comfort of the Western cliché held at the time, but the result of social transformation that abandoned socialist projects and violently dismantled socialism in a kind of shock doctrine that Naomi Klein called strategy of neoliberalism gaining momentum through the political crisis it creates, starting with Chile after Pinochet coup in 1973, continuing to form a Soviet Union and countries of the Eastern Bloc, Asian crisis in the late 90s, and many other places and wars, including Yugoslavia in the 90s. Whatever is the case with Yugoslav socialism, what replaced it was a process of violent transformation, part of a story in which outbursts of post-socialist nationalism in Yugoslavia should be seen as produced out of the logic of Western capitalism rather than being external to it. Within the broader picture of the demise of really existing socialism, of which, mind you, Yugoslavia was not part since its breakup from Stalin in 1948, after which the country fed from its individual way to socialism. Nevertheless, if dismantling followed the same logic like the other part, like the countries of really existing socialism, in which beneath the surface of political struggle, the issues were fundamentally economic, following a program imposed by International Monetary Fund, which defines transition as stabilization, which means anti-inflation, liberalization, privatization, without any political debate about the social desirability of that transformation. The invitation for this lecture asks us to talk about the political position of VHV, not to dwell on any particular project, which is what I'm trying to do in this lengthy descriptions of political and social context of our work. But being a curator, always organized as collective, that political position finds its expression primarily in exhibitions we organized over the years, in which what unfriendly critics might call our revolutionary rhetoric relaxes its armature and gains in modesty and completeness. That is why I will mention our projects throughout this talk without going into details, but rather trying to show some thematic complexes, procedures and obsessions that run through our project and political position they embody. From today's perspective, it looks that this politics of ours was very much built around what Susan Buck-Morse calls defining the enemy in her book Green World and Catastrophe, The Passing of Mass Utopia in East and West, a book she published in 2000, in which she compares collective imaginaries of capitalism and socialism as virtual worlds that through the process of making them real became social projects. Buck-Morse discusses one zone of power that is part of every state without difference whether the model of their legitimacy is the liberal claim of political form of democracy based on universal mass suffrage or the socialist claim of economic substantive democracy based on the egalitarian distribution of social goods. In her argument that expands on Carl Schmitt's assertion that the act of identifying the enemy is the act of sovereignty, indeed the political act par excellence, Buck-Morse claims that defining the enemy is the act that brings the collective into being, that the act of naming the enemy is what brings the collective into being. in her argument, this opens the possibility of violent zone of power, in which the claim to the monopoly of violence cannot never be democratic, and which is intrinsic to every state, both acting democracies and former socialist states. It certainly applies to Yugoslavia, whose dissolution was followed by a series of wars that in Buckmore's argument follows logically from collective identity implying ethnic homogeneity, which also means that racism is never far from the surface, and as a consequence, she claims, fascism is not aberrant to the nation state imaginary, but rather its limit case. Within a political imaginary, the ethnic national distinctions between we and they set the terms of the possibility of war, the concept and hence the real possibility of genocide remain necessarily a part of the picture, she writes. This is obviously what has happened in Yugoslavia, with some of its consequences still being discussed at the European Court for War Crimes in The Hague. Buckmore's position of defining the enemy as the act that brings collective into being, and that when applied to collective identity includes monopoly to violence, in an inverted form, developed again in both national identities and nationalistic ideologies, that came to Wehrwerth in a metaphoric sense came into being through defining the enemy on a shared political position that argued against nationalism and the social group that connected Croatian society during the 90s, but also nowadays. In our view, nationalism was the basic element around which main social and political forces have been formed after the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the change of social system from social self-management to neoliberal society of parliamentary democracy and market economy. Society was deeply imbued with nationalism, yet nationalism was the main issue not to be discussed, and we understood our work as being born in opposition to this dominant representative identity-based understanding of culture. Simply put, our projects were steaming towards open space for public discussion on issues that were ignored, made unfashionable by their lack of neural grammar and non-marketability, swept under the carpet or even openly suppressed. We were constantly keeping this basic question in the core of our activities, simultaneously trying to address the changes of context. For example, in a series of projects that were specifically dealing with the notion of normalization, through which we also attempted to address our complicity in these processes. We understood normalization as a process following the end of nationalistic governments across ex-Yugoslavia, with parties who won the elections on promise of normalcy, to which Western late capitalist societies, as well as states in which human rights are fully respected, are supposed to be closed. We saw this normalcy as the product of Western neoliberal ideology, with questions about price of that normalization never being asked. And consequently, all its other results, unemployment, poverty, crime, widening of class differences, decrease of social and health security, conservative backlash, rise of ethnic, racial and sexual intolerance, etc. All of those have not been understood as regular products and symptoms of liberal capitalist system, but as mere side effects. Side effects was the title of the exhibition we did in Belgrade in 2003, which was the first post-war exhibition in Belgrade of contemporary artists from Croatia, though not only from Croatia, which is in itself obviously a sign of normalization. We worked around the questions of normalization for a couple of years, with series of diverse projects dealing with collective amnesia, anti-fascist heritage, relations to monuments, questions of abstraction and modernism. For example, we made the exhibition called Project Broadcast, dedicated to Nikola Tesla. This is on the Communist Manifesto. So this project broadcasting in 2001 addressed the issues of economical and political interests that prevent full realization of the radically democratic potential of new technology. Also issues like copyright, intellectual property, science and art funding, distribution and utilization of science, and descriptions of artistic and scientific working processes in outcomes. And the whole exhibition was dedicated to Nikola Tesla, he's here on the image, born in 1856, died in 1943. He was a Serb from Croatia who died as an American citizen. Scientist claimed and disowned by Croats, Serbs, Yugoslavs and Americans, who invented more than 800 patents and laid theoretical grounds for the development of radio, radars, satellites, electronic microscopes, microwaves, fluorescent bulbs, etc. And who in Croatia during the 90s, from national hero, became persona non grata, as in these years his Serbian origin seriously damaged his cult status as a scientist. He was the guy who invented the electricity, who wanted to have electricity for free, and who lost from Edison, who employed electricity as a commercial enterprise. But he's actually quite well known as a scientist. And in 2002, when he made this exhibition, he was really absolutely erased from the last 10 years of Croatian history. And before that, as a child, he was brought to his museum, he was brought to his place where he was born. He was really a national hero. So this exhibition we made in 2002. And then we revisited this, his name, and also within the scope of a project called Normalization. Some years later, in 2006, we made a project explicitly titled Normalization dedicated to Nikola Tesla. The 150th anniversary of his birth was celebrated in grand style in Croatia. And Tesla became a powerful rhetorical symbol of the political reconciliation between Croats and Serbs. So, for example, there was a street dedicated to him, he never was a street, but then they added plaque. And this is really at the very center of the city, very close to the Gallery Biran. Then there was a big construction for some time, on and off, and then they relocated his monument from a secluded place at the university, they put it here. And in a ceremony in which all the politicians were present, and then they opened it. Ceremony. There were millions of these gestures of celebrating Tesla in 2006, and the sculpture was really not really so good at this particular place. And this is how it more or less ended up as a parking lot, but he still sleeps there. So we organized an archive exhibition actually on Tesla's presence in the public discourse in the 50s, and we also made an open call for an anti-monument to Nikola Tesla, in this creation to this and many more of the kind. And this open call, which aims to investigate his reflections on this recreation process of Tesla. Over a decade, Tesla was absent from the public discourse, marginalized, but at best, left over to minority cultures, and our position was that it was not accidental, but a logical consequence of the politics and culture in which all cultural, scientific, historical achievements were defined exclusively in terms of ethnicity and nationality. We argued that celebratory inclusion of Tesla in the narrative of national culture presupposes exclusion of the public's reflections on the war period, that those are only ritualistic gestures that are proclaiming and finalized the unsolved traumatic processes of the 90s, also including the fact that in 1995, 150,000 Serbs were expelled within the military action squad from Croatia, which abruptly solved Croatian issues with distribution of ethnicities and marked the end of the war. So Serbian minority in Croatia from 10% declined to 2% and this was the end of the war. So this is the part of the posters we made in the gallery. But, so these three colors, red, white, blue are the colors of Croatian flag. And this sculpture is a sculpture which was destroyed during the war in the city of Auschwitz, where he was born, because he was really not wanted at the time. I mean, many more cultures than this poet. So this, in 2006, this working around anti-monuments, he also continued being this paying attention to monuments. Monuments as materialization of the collective memory, and the fact that more than 2,500 monuments commemorate the positive history of unconscious struggle of socialist Yugoslavia. So 2,500 of them were removed or destroyed in the 90s. This was the impetus to revisit the work of modernist sculptor Vojin Vatić, who died in 92. He's an artist who is on one hand perceived as authentic modernist sculptor, main figure of the breakup with social realism, which happened in 48, as I mentioned, after the breakup with Stalin. So Yugoslavia had only for very few years after the Second World War something which could be called social realism. But still, the struggle to come to abstraction was very not easy phase on his part, and he was a proponent of the struggle. Understood as the main figure of the breakup social abstraction, who forged the path for freedom of artistic expression in the 50s. But on the other hand, he was always understood as a state artist, whose art has influenced his ideology, because he made really a number of monuments to anti-fascist anti-fascist struggle. For example, here I have a series of photos for abstract sculptures made in 1969. With the help of Croatian aviation, French aviation. It was the biggest abstract sculpture at the moment in Europe, commemorating anti-fascist struggle. So it was really a big enterprise. Okay. This is how it looked in the end, and this is how it looks today. So it was destroyed in the 90s, and they didn't manage to blow it up so easily. So there were really repeated attempts to blow it up, and they managed, and we know who made it, but they didn't really accept it. This was really just a completely acceptable gesture in those years. I have some more images of his monument. This is the one in Petrovagora made in late 70s, which is 52 years ago. This photo, in the meantime, it's deteriorated further, and now we are it was a monument and kind of learning center on the place of the Partizan Hospital on the Liberty Zone. Kind of museum, but also a sculpture in which one could enter. So it's still falling apart. And we are trying to, I mean, me and many other people are now trying to work around this. So, we made this exhibition of Vojin Vatić, which was the first time that we stepped into the institutionally guided terrain of modernism in socialist Yugoslavia, and claiming the current revisionist view that is inscribed in post-Second World War Yugoslavian abstraction. A tendency of restoration of belonging to Western European cultural circle. And this is, of course, the mainstream idea is that abstraction brought us back to the European Western circle. We stood against it. And this is the view, this mainstream view that understands modernism as a certain continuity of bourgeois culture. But he claimed that this view fails to comprehend that exactly this bourgeois traditionalist culture, prone to academism, strongly resisted modernistic tendencies, and that modernism stands on the positions of social changes that ideologically is closer to socialist project than to bourgeois culture. This is basic argument. Since our first project in Vatić, which we later did in the Gallery North, we worked with the material which was left in the bigger family, so we didn't borrow the work from the public collections. We worked only with what they still have in home, in our horrible conditions. The idea was also to try to raise some awareness to keep this collection, and we could not really provide it with the conditions for the sculptures, so those were mostly small sculptures. We closed the gallery has a window front, and the exhibition would be seen only through the window. So it's a kind of, it's not only conceptual art, only style of curators, it is also really outcome of the necessity of the material condition of the sculptures. But since then, and this was in 2006, we also showed this exhibition in Austria, and Austria is always in kind of guardian of what's going on in south of Austria, which includes ex-Yugoslavia and all the Balkans. So we also presented there, and some of these drawings were traveling to other exhibitions in Europe. But generally, the ideological battle over modernism that we started with this exhibition, over modernism in socialist Yugoslavia, first of all, and its liberty and importance today, and the theme of socialist monuments, in the meantime got more attention in the work of a new generation of artists, writers, art historians, and athletes, and even within official cultural and political institutions. Maybe some of you know the work of Croatian artist David Michalic. He worked a lot around the monument that I showed, this one, Batic. Also, and this is quite a lot shown in Croatia. Obviously, the context of our work was changing, also our circumstances, from informal, self-organized team based on friendship to complex partnerships, permanent gallery space, increased international visibility, and insurmountable and ever-increasing amount of bureaucracy. But the main political position against the one zone of power in Croatia, for us, inextricably related to nationalism, remained constant. We always attempted to connect our projects to broader questions of so-called European identity and international solidarity based on exploration of a discourse of East, West versus West, with which we kept very complicated relations, expressing almost all of our projects and running through our numerous collaborations with artists and cultural workers across former Eastern Europe, as well as with other ghost geographies. Geographies that were to various degrees struggling with their imposed and internalized marginal position in relation to the Western or solid projects of modernism. Geographies like Middle East, Central Asia, to mention just a few. Also geographies in which contemporary art is always inserting tension to the ideas of authentic, autochthonic national culture. We were focused on tentative encounters with the lived experience of multiple experimental modernisms, positive not as examples of another modernization, but as integral part of modernization per se, and also on critical investigations of hegemonic relations of cultural geopolitics, possible opposition of strategies, as well as questions of discrepancy between local and international perceptions. Throughout diverse projects concerned with these issues, background of a local Croatian context and our anti-nationalistic position strongly determined our work, and this is what could be described as the idea of our collective, in the sense the term is used in the essay grouped as a bearer of ideas by Dietrich Krakauer, author who announced what later will be called cultural studies, and whose essay, published in Germany during the Weimar Republic in Allgemeine Zeitung, and first published in German in the 60s as a book, translated into English in the 80s under the title The Mass Ornament, so his essay from Weimar Times today is certainly made for a timely reading. In the group as a bearer of ideas, Krakauer writes about how corporeality or socially effective idea is produced by individualities making the group, carefully delineating the communities of life and faith from those groups that actually bear ideas, as he said. And he also carefully showed how the idea imposes itself on a group and in its turn creates individuality. This particular dynamic between group and individual was at the core of our project called Collective Creativity in 2005, which we realized in Unhalle Christiano. But at that time, I have some images, but I'm still reluctant to go to them, so maybe I should get them out. Yeah.
Sorry. So at that time, we were more interested in how collective is much more than a sum of its parts, as John Hendricks, member of Guerrilla Art Action Group, wrote it in the 60s already. We were interested in how instrumentality of collective work is always smaller than the circles of enjoyment it creates. The main focus has been on different forms of collective artistic work evolving around certain social tensions that serve as a common axis around which various group activities are being organized. We were interested in placing the strategies that are taken by collectives in public space in alternative forms of sociability they are generating, how they occupy and change the system and the conditions of production and representation, mapping transgenerational and international links and connections based on the perspectives of cultural zones, which render the reading of modernity as a unique and homogeneous cultural capital of the West very problematic. And we especially focused in this particular exhibition on Latin America and Eastern Europe, as always, and we really tried to show some faces of the work between generations. So, for example, we showed a number of groups from Latin America, young groups at the time, like etc., visually, Tala Popular, the Telegrafia, it was also the time after Argentinian collapse, economic collapse in 2001, and it was really like a hit of speed, so there was a lot of collective resurfacing at the time. But then also groups like Stadelas, Radek, also from Russia, temporary services. But and then we pair them, not directly pair them, but then we compare them, we try to show these cases in the work of older generations, showing works like General Ideas, Tucumán Arte in Argentina, Collective Action from Moscow, etc. It was rather big exhibition if it's something artists. But to go back to Krakauer, his account on how the lifespan of a group is determined by the goal of the service the group constituted itself, his account of the goal of the lifespan of the group is rather pessimistic. At the time, the work of collective creativity is rather focused on the duration of a group as something that gives it a substance, in distinction and opposition to temporary collaboration, which at the time, in 2005, were all the hype as part of so-called relational aesthetics and were much discussed in the art world as often intrinsically politically effective and as challenging the status quo. It really stood against it. This enthusiasm though, which from today's perspective looks very much like a sign of the times, this forward march of post-Fordism transformation lost much of its appeal. In this light, Krakauer writing on group involvement with ideas and their duration assumes for us new importance. Krakauer writes, let us assume that at the time of the group's founding, the members set up a hard and fast program containing all the demands to be made of the current state of reality according to the idea that generates the group. While the group individuality then goes about intervening in reality according to the terms of this program, that reality itself changes, to some extent also as a result of the group's action. A new situation arises that demands a different stance on the part of the group. He continues to describe how the group penetrates into reality and how it simultaneously experiences the power of that reality. How the logic of reality replaces what he calls the logic of reality, the logic of idea, and how group then typically responds to this reality, either splitting into reformist and radical things, caught in a messy conflict, or when the group has made it and its position is no longer threatened, then slowly withdrawing from the idea as such in its progressive immersion in reality. From that point on, the group continues by inertia, yearning only to assert itself in terms of power. And he said, its ideas become pure decoration, ostentatious facades for a party of the interior. The idea takes sublime revenge on the now powerful group, he concludes. So this is the scheme, how this happens. These questions that we could ignore 6-7 years ago, when we were first enchanted with gestures of collective work, became an obvious subject, especially after we curated Istanbul Biennial in 2009, certainly our internationally most visible project, for better or worse, in which we summarized many of our constant concerns in the exhibition, which was called What Keeps Mankind Alive, with its title taken from the song of the same name from the Three Penny Opera, written in 1928 by Bertolt Brecht, in collaboration with Elizabeth Hauptmann and Kurt Weill. The concept of the exhibition relied on Brecht's play, this particular one, Three Penny Opera, and also on its critical, on its critical thematization of the process of the redistribution of ownership within bourgeois society, but also on Brecht's methods in general, and the parallels between the burgeoning liberal economy's capacity to erode the hitherto existing social consensus in 1928, when the play was written, and in the present time, in the very moment when an economic crisis of epic proportions exploded throughout the world. We stress that today, as then, one of the consequences of the economic crisis has been the massive rightward shift of the European electoral body, and that the outcome of crisis depends on our activities, or activity. The exhibition did not claim to be Marxist, not the central concept of Marxism as party and proletariat, but it did recall communist hypotheses, that you would call it. True, the exhibition was met with considerable criticism from many sides, and most immediate commentators distanced themselves from the political thrust, either through open attacks, or in more subtle ways through patronizing and dismissive praises. But nevertheless, and somewhat contradictory, most of the reviews were never failing to praise impeccably installed show, admirable research behind it, and generally the quality of the work and of the exhibition. So one could also claim that the exhibition enjoyed a reasonable level of success, especially in one place. Following Brecht, this success can be measured only in tension with its income, or as Heinrich Müller put it, one is always overtaken by success before a real impact can occur. As long as the thing works, it is not successful, and when success is there, then the impact is over. This lesson for us certainly intensified questions on the duration and role of this our focus. Although the positions are of course not as clear-cut as in his analysis, and the power involved is precluded by increasing precarity and pressures on cultural production, especially less cultural production, which is certainly and increasingly not characteristic only of creation. Also, in the meantime, the question how to navigate away from dreadful options that in Krakauer times proved to be self-fulfilling prophecies, playing out in the historical nightmare of Nazism and World War II. At the present moment, the European order, as established in the aftermath of the war, seems to be falling apart, and we are witnessing the increasing rise of the right-wing politics in the Netherlands, Hungary, Finland, Sweden, Austria, European Parliament, to name just a few, and not to mention Denmark. It became increasingly urgent. This rise of fascist politics was the subject of one of our last exhibitions called Details, that opened in Bergen-Bunskau in September, addressing the issue that in Norwegian context after July attacks in Oslo and Stockholm became really topical. Krakauer answered to the question of escaping the terrible either-or of the two positions, which he described as position of skeptic as a matter of principle and position of short-sighted people, both to endorse position of waiting. Perhaps the only remaining attitude is one of waiting. One waits, and one's waiting is an attitude of openness. One could hardly be blamed for objecting that in the case of Krakauer and his generation, This waiting did not end up all too well. But perhaps there really is not much choice left in today's culture that became into colony of society, focused on services and consumption. The public sphere is attempting to reconstruct the new market conditions. Its critique, being internalized and institutionalized, produced through self-preferential and self-perpetuating disciplinary field of artism. This flexibility and inclusiveness of foundation sector, the dominant material basis of contemporary art production, taking over critical discourse within its multicultural enlightening rhetoric. In a more positive light, this is a moment of strategic waiting that is not facility, that involves sustaining openness to test modalities of art production and critical thinking within and at the edges of the existing system, and sustaining it over a long period of time, because bad times could last very long, as Franco Berardi Biffo warned us, imagining, as he writes, a cultural revolution based on the force of exhaustion, of facing the inevitable decay, discovering the senseless slowness of those who do not expect any more from life than wisdom, the wisdom of those who have seen a great deal without forgetting, who look at each thing as if for the first time. Maybe this is something and we are willing to try standing up to. And here I would like to finish. Thank you.